Welcome to Cool Stuff Ride Home. Marcus Paff joining you today. Reggie Rizzou will be along momentarily with This Day in History. On today's episode, what's really being said when a gorilla beats its chest? A new solar-powered technology could be scaled to provide fresh drinking water to billions. And on This Day in History, the Cecil Rhodes Scholarship was founded. We'll have details. That's all coming up on Cool Stuff. Well, not sure if you've ever stopped to think about a gorilla beating its chest and what exactly that means. To some extent, the visual is almost cliche at this point, as it appears in nearly every movie to feature the great ape. Insert King Kong reference here. I think it's fair to say many people consider the sight to be a warning of sorts, indicating the gorilla is ready to fight if necessary, with the chest beating a show of strength. At least that's always been my own personal interpretation. In some instances, it's also been shown to be a celebratory behavior, at least in popular media. But real evidence for any of this has been sparse, and we're now learning those previous suspicions may not tell the entirety of the story. New research, based on years of observation of mountain gorillas, shows there's more to this behavior than previously thought. Let's start by clearing up one minor error that seems to originate with the movies. When beating their chest, gorillas actually use cupped hands, not fists, the way is often portrayed, the purpose of which is to amplify the sound that they make. And the activity itself appears to serve multiple functions. Per National Geographic, citing research from primatologist Edward Wright, a male mountain gorilla's hearty chest beat would seem to signal aggression, but the behavior may actually prevent violence between the massive animals, which can top out at nearly 500 pounds apiece. Mountain gorillas live in tight-knit family groups led by silverback males whose authority is constantly being challenged by other males. By advertising their size, mating status, and fighting ability via sounds that can travel long distances through rainforests, the silverbacks are signaling to would-be challengers that they better think again before starting a fight. Now, to study the behavior in detail, Wright and his colleagues spent more than 3,000 hours between 2014 and 2016 observing endangered mountain gorillas at Volcanoes National Park in Rwanda. He and his colleagues used acoustic monitoring equipment to record the frequencies of the chest beats, as well as the number of beats and duration of each display. All this to determine the chest thumping is a demonstration of body size. By beating their chest, air sacs beneath the larynx reverberate from the kinetic energy, producing a sound. And the bigger the male, the deeper that sound. This is believed to broadcast just how big and dominant a particular male gorilla is as a means of keeping rival males away from their social group. It's also believed that each thump may help members of the dominant male's group to identify the silverback from this sound. This means chest beating isn't just a visual display, but what the study calls an honest signal of competitive ability, not unlike the alligator's rumble or bison's bellow. Now again, per National Geographic, previous studies showed a gorilla's body size is linked to dominance and reproductive success, but the idea of chest beating communicating any of that information was speculative at best. Primatologist Roberta Salmi told Nat Geo, quote, "We thought and suspected, but there was no actual data to support this claim. I was happy to finally see the results," end quote. Silverbacks beat their chest most when females under their protection are entering estrus, the time when they're most ready to mate, but it's still not an activity males perform with a great deal of regularity, as is often portrayed in movies. Wright found that each male beat its chest an average of just 1.6 times every 10 hours. Now, lower-level male gorillas, often referred to as subordinates, also perform the chest-beating behavior, as do baby male gorillas when they're playing. Interestingly, Wright says there doesn't appear to be a relationship between how big or dominant a male is and how many times it strikes its chest, or for how long the display actually lasts. And while the gorillas may look like they're equipped for a good fight, it's actually a pretty rare occurrence, and researchers believe this may have a lot to do with the information communicated via chest beating. Per Wright, quote, "Even if you're likely to win a fight, there's still quite a high risk factor. These are large, powerful animals that could do a lot of damage," end quote. For smaller males, the sound of a silverback's chest beat may discourage them from approaching. Similarly, a large silverback may hear the beats made by a smaller male and determine it's too tiny to even bother with. Because chest beat peak frequency syncs up with body size, which is linked to reproductive success, female gorillas seemingly have reason to listen in on the displays as well. Salmi has also studied chest beating in the closely related western lowland gorilla. This species also performs a hand-clapping behavior, but apparently is a way to alert others to potential danger, something that so far has not been observed in mountain gorillas. Per Salmi, the next step now is to see how other gorillas use the information encoded in chest beating sounds. Quote, "It will be very interesting to see how hearing chest beats in their environments might affect their movements and decision-making as to which areas of their home range to use," end quote. Well, I'll just opine for a moment on this. One, it is interesting to get a better feel for what exactly this activity means in the gorilla world. That said, if I ever come face to face with a gorilla and it's not at a zoo where they're confined by a cage of some sort, I'm not approaching any one of them beating their chest. These gorillas may not be looking for a fight, but they're certainly looking to deter you or any other male gorilla from trying to engage in one.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Per Andy Corbley and the Good News Network, scientists have developed a new solar-powered system that converts salt water into fresh drinking water, and it's believed this could help reduce the risk of waterborne illnesses like cholera in less developed countries. Making this new system even better, the team used real-world testing to show the process is more than 20% cheaper than traditional methods and can be deployed in rural locations around the globe. That latter note is particularly important as more than 2 billion people depend upon groundwater for drinking, yet around 1.7 billion reside in areas with stressed groundwater supplies, notably in India and China. Groundwater quality is further compromised by natural and human-induced salinization, turning much of it brackish or saline. So, researchers from King's College London, in collaboration with MIT and the Helmholtz Institute for Renewable Energy Systems, created this new system, which built upon existing processes that produces consistent levels of water using solar power. The results were reported in a paper recently published in the peer-reviewed journal Nature Water. It works through a process called electrodialysis, which separates the salt using a set of specialized membranes that channel salt ions into a stream of brine, leaving behind fresh, drinkable water. By flexibly adjusting the voltage and the rate at which salt water flows through the system, the scientists develop something that adjusts to variable sunshine while not compromising on the amount of fresh drinking water produced. Using data first gathered in India before recreating those conditions in New Mexico, the team successfully converted up to 10 cubic meters, or several bathtubs worth of fresh drinking water. This is enough water for roughly 3,000 people a day, and with the process continuing to run regardless of variable solar power caused by cloud cover and rain. Dr. Wei He from the Department of Engineering at King's College London believes the new technology could bring massive benefits to rural communities in particular, not only increasing the supply of drinking water, but also bringing health benefits. Quote, "By offering a cheap, eco-friendly alternative that can be operated off the grid, our technology enables communities to tap into alternative water sources to address water scarcity and contamination in traditional water supplies. This technology can expand water sources available to communities beyond traditional ones, and by providing water from uncontaminated saline sources, may help combat water scarcity or unexpected emergencies when conventional water supplies are disrupted, for example, like the recent cholera outbreak in Zambia," end quote. Now, as mentioned, 1.7 billion people face water scarcity, but 56% of worldwide groundwater is saline and not suitable for consumption. The issue is particularly prevalent in India, where 60% of the land harbors undrinkable saline water. Consequently, there is a pressing need for efficient desalination methods to create fresh drinking water cheaply and at scale. Again, per Corbley and GNN, traditional desalination technology has relied on costly batteries in off-grid systems or a grid system to supply the energy necessary to remove salt from the water. And in developing countries, particularly in rural areas, grid infrastructure can be wholly unreliable. Creating a low-cost desalination technology using solar removes the overall reliance on costly battery technology, too. Per Dr. He, quote, by removing the need for a grid system entirely and cutting reliance on battery tech by 92%, our system can provide reliable access to safe drinking water, entirely emission-free, on-site, and at a discount of roughly 22% to the people who need it compared to traditional methods, end quote. The system also has the potential to be used outside of developing areas, particularly in agricultural regions where climate change is leading to unstable reserves of fresh water for irrigation. The team plans to scale up the availability of the technology across India through collaboration with local partners. And beyond that, a team from MIT also plans to create a startup to commercialize and fund the technology. Once again, per he, quote, while the U.S. and U.K. have more stable, diversified grids than most countries, they still rely on fossil fuels. By removing fossil fuels from the equation for energy-hungry sectors like agriculture, we can help accelerate the transition to net zero. The next step for us is to apply the low-cost technology to other sectors, including wastewater treatment and producing alkaline to make the ocean more alkaline to help it absorb more CO2 from the atmosphere. By taking this approach, not only can we decarbonize agriculture, but wider environmental and climate benefits as well, end quote. Well, on its face, this seems like a pretty darn cool story. I will note, not to be a skeptic, but it feels like we've heard of similar solutions in the past, and yet we're still facing this issue in a number of developing nations. So while I love the story and I'm anxious to see where it goes and will remain optimistic, there is still some degree of skepticism in my mind until we can figure out a way to, I guess, mass produce this and ensure that it is installed and available to all of the people that need it globally. As we like to say on this show, time will tell.
Taking a look at this day in history, on April 4th, 1902, the Cecil Rhodes Scholarship was founded. It was established by the will of Cecil Rhodes, a British businessman, mining magnate, and politician who played a major role in the expansion of the British Empire in Africa. Rhodes intended the scholarship to promote leadership, public service, and international understanding among young people from around the world. While the Rhodes Scholarship remains a symbol of academic excellence, leadership, and international cooperation that reflects Cecil Rhodes' vision of fostering the development of future leaders who will work towards a better world, it isn't without controversy. So Rhodes was born in 1853 in Bishop Stortford, England, and made his fortune in the diamond mining industry in southern Africa, particularly in present-day Zimbabwe and Zambia, which were then known as Rhodesia, which was named after him. Obviously, there's a little controversy there. As we know, diamond mining in Africa, there can be some issues there. I'm not going to get in depth on that, but I think we all know about some of the issues there. He was also involved in politics, serving as prime minister of the Cape Colony, which is now part of South Africa. Rhodes had a vision of promoting Anglo-Saxon unity and believed that English-speaking people should rule the world and spread British values and institutions. So some believe Rhodes was a white supremacist, which seems likely after hearing that he felt English-speaking people should rule the world and British values and institutions should be prominent. So I'm going to guess that might be accurate. It is also believed that his intention was that scholars should be white because, like I said, potentially a white supremacist. A Black American, Elaine L. Locke, was awarded the scholarship, though, in 1907. But thereafter, there were virtually no Black scholars until the 1960s. It was only in 1977 that the first Black South African was awarded the Rhodes Scholarship. Until 1976, candidates had to be unmarried males between the ages of 19 and 25 and citizens of and have at least 5 years of residency in the British Commonwealth or colonies, the Republic of South Africa, or the United States. Candidates from Germany were considered in 1903 to 1914, and then again in 1930 to 1939. And from 1970, two candidates were chosen each year from the Federal Republic of Germany. It wasn't until 1976 before women were accepted as candidates. In 2018, the scholarships were open to students of all nations. Rhodes Scholars are selected based on academic achievement, leadership qualities, and commitment to making a positive difference in the world. The Rhodes Scholarship is administered by the Rhodes Trust, which is based at Rhodes House in Oxford. The selection process is highly competitive, with only a small number of scholars chosen each year from thousands of applicants worldwide. Rhodes Scholars receive funding for tuition, fees, and living expenses. So while it may have some controversy with the person who founded it, overall, the Rhodes Scholarship is still a fantastic thing, as it can help kids that are smart, intelligent, potential leaders, all those things that could be positive in the world, go to school where they may not have been able to afford it otherwise. As long as you're in that category, good grades, they have that whole list of criteria. As long as you can meet some or all of those, it could potentially change your life and make the world better. So again, a little bit of a questionable history there. In the end, though, I still believe it is a good thing.
Oh, yeah. I obviously a good thing, certainly with what it has evolved into. There's no debate to even be had about that. A scholarship for a worthy individual? Absolutely. All these years, I have known or heard about the Rhodes Scholars, but I never knew from which they came or where the term came from. And now we do with Cecil Rhodes. But like you said, a checkered past, to say the least. An individual who appears to have carried a lot of bigotry and discriminatory practices, behaviors with him. That part of it is highly unfortunate. But the fact that this has now evolved to be something offered to individuals around the globe, despite the fact it still carries his name with it, is without question a positive thing for these individuals who have demonstrated, as you put it, academic excellence, leadership, and international cooperation. And that'll do it for yet another edition of Cool Stuff Ride Home. As always, reach out to us, coolstuffcommute@gmail.com. Would love to hear from you. Corrections, omissions, thoughts, questions, whatever you have, send it our way. And we look forward to being right back here tomorrow with you for more cool stuff.